You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
For many North Americans, grabbing a bunch of bananas with every grocery shop is a routine act. In many ways, it's an unnatural act. Bananas are a jungle fruit, and their ubiquitous and cheap character in our food supply came about through a concerted and in many ways cruel campaign by the United Fruit Company, the forerunner of Chiquita. Now the cheap and exotic fruit we take for granted is on a path of extinction. Dan Capel has charted the rise and decline of the modern banana in his book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. The book traces the 7,000-year history of the banana and brings us up to date with the crisis faced by a single and widespread species, the Cavendish. Hi, Dan. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Great. Now, the title of your book makes a very big statement. How did the banana change the world?
Well, it's changed the world in so many ways, and both the modern world and the ancient world. The banana was the very first cultivated fruit, and 7,000 years ago it emerged from the jungles and it spread around the world, and it has been an important crop, a subsistence crop for people ever since then. It is a major crop, the fourth largest. It feeds people all around the world, and in modern times the banana has become the most important fruit for us, and it literally has changed nations. It has caused revolutions, and it has changed the way we in North America and Europe and in the temperate parts of the world eat and look at the world, really.
What's threatening the banana?
The banana right now is threatened by an incurable fungus called Panama disease, and this disease has already wiped out thousands of acres of banana plantations in Asia. It's a devastating disease that spreads like wildfire as soon as it hits. It has not hit our plantations in Latin America, where we get all of our bananas from, but there's no doubt that it's coming, and when it comes, if things stay the same, it will wipe out all of our banana plantations as well.
And in North America, the banana, it's not really, what I would describe anyway as an essential food beyond the loss of a very unique taste and a handy snack. Why should we care so much about the banana's demise?
Well, it is interesting. I actually think on some levels it is an essential food. And one of the things that's important to realize about bananas, and the reason it's essential, is that the banana is the cheapest fruit we get, and it is unnaturally cheap if you think about it. It comes from thousands of miles away. It's incredibly perishable. A banana lasts about 14 days after it is cut from the tree, and yet it costs less than an apple, which is shipped from 100 or 200 miles. But at that price, a banana competes not with other fruits, but it competes with potato chips and candy. It's the last line of defense in the war against obesity, in a sense. It's that important, and yet you're right, in a sense. It's not necessary to our diet, and it is unnatural in the sense that it comes from the tropics, and it was only introduced 125 years ago, and it was unheard of, and it was sort of, it wasn't forced upon us. It seduced us. It was invented by brilliant marketers who used all kinds of techniques to tame the jungle, to tame people, brutal techniques. And then they seduced the American public and the Canadian public to learn about bananas and fall in love with this fruit. So it's a paradoxical thing. It's an important fruit for our diets and for having fruit in our diets, yet it's also a completely alien thing, and it really shouldn't be here on many levels.
In other parts of the world, how important is the banana in the diet?
Well, they just completed a few weeks ago a huge conference in Africa on the future of the banana there, and there's a desperate race to save the fruit on the African continent, where in many parts of that continent, the banana is so essential that it counts for 90% of people's calories. People there, if they lose the banana, they starve. Just to give you an example, we in North America eat about 25 pounds of bananas a year. That's 2, 3, or 4 bananas a week. Heavy consumers, a 4 banana a week consumer. 25 pounds is a lot, but in Uganda, for example, some people eat 900 pounds of bananas a year. That's, like I said, 80 to 90% of their diet. So you lose bananas and people literally will starve to death. And that's a huge problem. And that reliance on bananas spreads across parts of Asia, the Pacific. So it's an incredibly important crop.
Wow, those are amazing numbers. You alluded to the more recent history of the banana over the probably over the 20th century. How exactly did the banana move from a jungle fruit to one that was grown in huge plantations?
Well, it was inspiration. That's the only way to put it. It's kind of hard to believe that somebody just looked at a banana sitting on a dock in Jamaica. Bananas were grown in the Caribbean, and said, "Wow, this is a gold mine." It doesn't make any sense, yet that's what happened. A single entrepreneur, a sea captain from Cape Cod, decided to bring a bunch of bananas over to New Jersey, of all places, and sell them as a way to have something on his ship on the way back north. He bought another load of cargo south, and it was a hit. And he decided that he needed to sell some more. And this really was a difficult and impossible thing. And bananas are just impossible to ship. They need to be shipped cold, and they rot so easily, and they're so fragile. You know, a banana bruised in your supermarket bag just on the trip home from the grocery becomes brown so quickly. And yet they decided, he quickly gained some partners, some people who saw this potential as well, and they were aggressive men, and they quickly decided on a strategy that bananas were going to be the most popular fruit. They were going to be cheaper than apples, and this strategy has guided the banana industry to this day. And to do that, they had to grow bananas in Latin America. And to grow bananas in Latin America and sell them cheaper than apples, which were grown so close by, and to afford to grow bananas, which are expensive to grow, to ship, to handle, they really had to do terrible things. They literally had to take over Latin America. They couldn't afford to pay workers anything, really. They couldn't afford to pay for land. They had to pay for their shipping. They had to pay for distribution in the United States. So to sell bananas for less than local fruit here, they had to treat these countries and people not badly, but virtually unimaginably terribly. And these nations that were under the control of the banana companies came to be known as the Banana Republics. And over again, anytime there was a hint of discontent in these nations, the banana companies, with the help of the U.S. military, intervened over 20 times in the early, from 1900 to 1955, with bloody massacres. Thousands of people were killed, striking banana workers. And so this fruit that we were cutting into our cornflakes, that these very same banana companies were inventing recipes for and animated cartoon characters and making us really fall in love with, had this bloody backstory, this terrible history. And this is the paradox and fascinating thing about the banana. It's so plain and wonderful and friendly to us, yet at the same time it almost established sort of this globalization, this manifest destiny, and this has this bloody history.
Now, in your book, you talk about people who play a role as kind of, I guess, a bit as enforcers in this whole dynamic called the bananeros. Am I saying it right? The banana men. What role did they play?
Well, the banana men are not just enforcers. The banana men was the term. The bananeros were the Americans who came down to work to run the banana plantations, and some of them were enforcers. There were colorful mercenaries with names like Machine Gun Maloney and Lee Christmas, who were two of the fellows who originally came down and overthrew the government of Honduras in the early 1900s when the Honduran officials refused to cooperate with the future head of Chiquita. But bananeros were also scientists who did breeding, so that's a generic term, and it's still used as a generic term to some extent for anyone who comes from far away. But the bananeros were swashbucklers. They saw themselves as taming the jungle. They cut down thousands of acres of rainforest. They were true pioneers in that way, and many of them were you know, so-called men of action, whether they were scientists or machine gun wielding thugs. They came and they saw and they conquered, and they did it all in the name of the banana, and many of them became multimillionaires as well.
Now, some countries resisted, Guatemala in the forefront. What kind of resistance did these poor countries mount to the colonization by United Fruit?
There was an ebb and flow of resistance constantly. The workers would elect governments, or there would be workers' movements that would be launched. And whenever this would happen, there would be brutal repression. Guatemala was probably the most famous example of it. And in 1954, Guatemala elected a president named Jacobo Arbenz, first democratically elected president in that country. He promised land reform. He asked that Chiquita give fallowed land, land that was not being used for banana growth, back to the workers. In response, Chiquita, with the help of the CIA, and this is documented by Freedom of Information Act releases, launched a horrifying coup. Thousands and thousands of people were killed. Arbenz was exiled. The government of Guatemala was overthrown, and this led to 30 years of instability in Guatemala and the Mayan genocide that continued up through the 1980s. It was one of the most terrible results of a banana-related overthrow. And you know, I live in Los Angeles, and even today we have Guatemalan refugees here from that genocide who can't go back home, and who many of whom will never discuss what they saw in the 1980s, especially when, you know, tens of thousands of their family members were being brutalized by the right-wing government that was installed following the overthrow of that president, who attempted to nationalize the banana fields and who was literally overthrown at the behest of the company that is now known as Chiquita Banana.
How did the original banana that was propagated by United Fruit, the Gros Michel, how did that die off, and how did the Cavendish come to repeat its pattern of monocultural rise and decline?
Right, that's something a lot of people don't know, and it surprises them, is that the banana that these bananeros first introduced, that people in the Americas and in North America fell in love with, is not the banana that we eat today. That original banana was called the Gros Michel banana, and it was a bigger, tougher, better tasting banana than the one we ate today. And it was made extinct, functionally extinct, as a commercial crop, I should say. Some still are grown very locally, by this same disease called Panama disease. And almost immediately, in the late 1890s, early 1900s, it began to be attacked by this disease, and plantations were laid fallow. And so the banana companies began to move their plantations. They began to search for new land. And every time, of course, they needed new land, they'd have to take it. So this disease actually is one of the reasons that they began to engage in these brutal practices. It wasn't just that they were needing new bananas to feed more and more people who were falling in love with this fruit. That was happening. But in addition, biology was one of the reasons. They couldn't grow bananas in the same places. So the more they needed land, the more they had to take. But they never searched for other ways to fight this disease. And they preferred to just steal land. So this disease is chasing the Gros Michel around Central America. Eventually, by 1960, the Gros Michel is extinct. There's no place left to grow this banana. But they do have a substitute, the banana we eat today, called the Cavendish. Now, the Cavendish banana is not a very good banana, and the banana industry, in fact, hated it. Chiquita has issued memos for 20 years saying, we're not going to use this banana. The housewives of North America are going to reject it because it doesn't taste as good. It's smaller, and plus, it's very hard to ship. Remember I said that it's expensive to ship bananas, and the Cavendish has to be put in boxes because it's too fragile, and it doesn't ripen properly, so you need extra technology. But the Cavendish resists Panama disease, and so they have no choice. Well, fast forward 40 years, new banana plantations have been planted in Asia for the first time to serve Asian cities that are growing. And Panama disease reappears. It's a new strain of it. And it begins to attack plantations in Asia. And it spreads across Asia very rapidly, at the even faster pace than it has spread across the Americas with the Gros Michel. And it has continued to spread. It was discovered in Malaysia about 20 years ago, and it has spread across oceans. It's now devastating plantations in Australia, to the point where Australia has actually instituted a banana tax as a way to find solutions for this, and so far they've found none. It hasn't hit our hemisphere yet, and Chiquita has just commented on it for the first time and has said that it's not worried. That it will be able to find ways to quarantine its farms. Now, no reputable banana scientist will tell you anything other than quarantines will always fail, and they failed in Australia. So Chiquita's in denial, just as it was 50 years ago, and this disease is coming. I can't say when. It could be 5 years or 10 years or 20. The point is that Panama disease is so easy to spread. If I carried a clump of it in my hand and threw it in a plantation in Panama, that would begin the spread, and it would happen very rapidly. So Cavendish is now facing this same collapse that the Gros Michel did. The difference is that this new Panama disease will spread faster, it's more virulent, and right now there's no single banana out there, even an inferior one, that we can propose as a substitute. And again, the banana companies have not really done anything to figure out what to do about this. And of course, they don't have the option of stealing any more land. That's not the way things work today. So there are things they can do, but today's outlook is pretty bleak if they keep conducting business as usual.
In writing a review of your book, Johan Hari in the Independent described the banana as a parable for our times. After developing such an engaged relationship with the banana and its history, what lessons do you think we ought to learn from this?
Well, I think the big lesson we need to learn is diversity. From the very start, the banana was a monoculture, and the banana as a monoculture is what leads to the blood. It's what leads to the collapse. It's what leads to the terror. Again, it was the biology that was the destiny of the banana. If you look at that disease that chased the banana across the Latin America, that was the reason the banana companies needed all that land. And if the banana companies hadn't just counted on the one single banana, if they'd grown three or four, they would have had a hedge against that. They wouldn't have needed that much land. They may have been able to create a fairer way of growing the banana. They may not have. But certainly today, the banana now, there are many, many bananas. There are over 1,000 different kinds of bananas grown throughout the world. And with three or four or five different kinds of bananas, you would have an entirely different kind of supply chain. The problem now is that for 100 years, bananas have been grown as a single crop. We've come to rely on bananas as that single cheap crop. It is almost impossible to remake the banana supply chain. The banana companies are entrenched. There's only two of them. So what's happened is that the banana is almost locked into its brutality, and although the banana companies aren't taking over countries, they are still paying bribes. They are still funding terrorism, for example. Chiquita just paid a $20 million fine for paying terrorists in Colombia. That money went to murder and to buying weapons. They're still using terrible pesticides, and the system hasn't really changed. And so the answer to the Cavendish problem, and the answer to your question, and the answer to the questions that are being raised in reviews of my book and in my book itself, is that the whole thing needs to be rethought. The way bananas are grown and the way workers are treated will only change if we grow more than one banana, and if workers have the chance to say, hey, there's a $3 a pound banana, there's a $2 a pound banana, there's a $1 a pound banana, and there's a commodity banana. And then there will be a way to vary these things and have a chance to make the banana more of a normal product instead of this product that is built on exploitation and so susceptible to a single disease that will destroy it all.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you this morning, Dan, and I'll point people towards the book and also towards your blog, which is focused on the banana.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's been great talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Dan Capel. He's the author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, and his blog is at bananabook.org.